When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
But Joe, on the first one, he's like, well, I'm gonna come in to see how it goes. So he sat there.
Kind of a snub.
So and then, no, he just sort of wanted to make And the second one, he had such a great time. He's like, I'm going to come in for another one. And about, what were you, about 15 episodes in, I was like, You need to stop saying hosted by Josh Olson, because It is both of us.
Sure.
But I think he's happiest letting me, you know, do the dirty work.
And he can just fire from the grassy knoll.
Exactly, basically. Right. So obviously, it's like the thing we're missing, aside from his lovely presence, is Joe has seen every movie ever made.
Right. It's too bad he couldn't call in or something.
It is a shame. And he is sorry not to be here.
Yeah, but, me too. I'm a fan. Well, tell him I'm a fan.
Absolutely. Well, he'll hear it. But thank you. And now there is a chance that at least the person you're talking to might not have seen every movie you're
quite watching. All right.
But
a lot of my movies, I have so many. When do you want to start? Like, are we starting now?
Oh, we've been talking.
Oh, so this is part of the podcast, right?
It is now.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
The part where you're, you know, bad mouthing the people you're working with, now we cut. But
yeah, okay, awesome.
But let me do, I don't like to do. We actually have this ongoing thing where I'm like, we shouldn't even say who's on, because you know how podcasts work. It's like, you know who the guest is, because
you make it your own thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and let me run through. First of all, I'm a huge fan.
Oh, thank you.
And I don't know if you tell me I shouldn't say this on the air, I will, but like, you should be hosting the fucking Daily Show.
Oh, I appreciate that, Josh.
It makes me insane. And I love the nightly show.
Yeah. But I have so many fans from that show.
It's shocking.
I know, but almost every day on Twitter, Certainly for the first 2 years afterwards, almost every single day somebody said, "Larry, I missed the nightly show." It was crazy.
Yeah, no, it's funny how, because it was like, all right, it's half an hour later, it's a different name. And sure. I love that show.
Yeah.
That was terrific. That was
Oh, thanks. We had a lot of fun doing it.
Clearly. I think that's essential, obviously, right?
Yeah.
I
mean, oh, you have to. You'll go crazy. You already will go crazy.
Yeah, and your audience can tell, I suspect. I feel like I can usually tell when someone's not enjoying their work.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Nobody wants to watch that. Let me
just run through a few. Creator of the Bernie Mac Show. That's a senior black correspondent on the Daily Show.
Senior black.
Host of the Nightly Show, co-creator of Insecure on HBO. Mm-hmm. I guess we can plug, it's a rival podcast. Make sure you listen to all of ours before you listen to this black on the air thing.
I don't know what that is.
So. But first and foremost, I do want to say it was your work as Terrorist Number 3.
Oh.
On Sledgehammer.
Wow.
Created by my friend Alan Spencer.
And then, wow. That is really
because really everything else pales in comparison to
absolutely.
Your...
Humble beginnings, man. Of course, that was after Officer Ziakis on The Facts of Life.
Yes. Not my, you know, show, but yeah, that was about little girls.
Nice.
Sledgehammer is a thing with guns.
Sledgehammer, so ahead of its time and of its time at the same time.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I've known Alan for a long time. In fact, I met you briefly during the strike through him, but easily one of the funniest human beings
completely
alive. And just if you're not following Alan Spencer on Twitter, you should, just because just every now and then a little bummo pops up and you just die.
He's always been like that. We went to high school together. He's always had
brilliant
comic mind, you know. Most of my days were spent hoping I could make him laugh. And feeling good when you did. It's like, woo, right? I made Alan laugh.
Exactly. No, he is the best. And I should have said this off the air. If you see me doing this,
playing with your phone?
Yeah, I'm probably just bored and texting my
wife.
Oh, no
problem. Not at all.
I do it all the time. No, I'm actually probably looking something up so I can sound smarter than I am.
Got it.
But Larry, thanks
for having me,
very much for coming.
I'm very happy to be here.
Joe is very sorry you couldn't be here. Last minute they came up.
Sorry to miss you, Joe. I'm a big fan, man.
And he of you. You wanted to talk about, I loved your idea. Why don't you tell?
Oh, sure. Well, I realized, when you first asked me about this, I thought, oh, wow, what a great name for a podcast. That sounds like fun. You know, just sit and talk about movies you love. I do this with my friends anyway.
Exactly.
You know? As you said. And
we should have beer for the guests.
Yeah, sure.
That's like, it's just,
no. And then, you know, when you mentioned put it into categories or people did this, I was like, that's tough. I love so many movies, right. You know, I'm like, I don't even know where to start. So I thought, okay, well, why don't I do this? Why don't I make like Larry Wilmore doubleheaders, you know,
yeah,
and link the movies for thematically from my own point of view, not necessarily that they're linked that way, but this right. is how I link them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like some because of what I like about them, some because of the movies themselves or whatever. And so that way I can, you know, depending on how much time I have, I'm able to talk about a lot of movies in a short amount of time, you know, which could be fun rather than talking about a couple of movies at right. length. Because yes. I'm not like a, you know, I'm not a movie reviewer, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, that is the whole thing. And we find sometimes when we go to guests, they're like, especially because of Joe, you know, they're a little intimidated. It's like, no, man, the idea is not to come in and dazzle us with, you know, bullshit about how you're supposed to talk about movies. Like, how do you think about this stuff?
Sure.
Because you're a guy who creates stuff that, you know, we're fans of. There's a creative process. It's what's going on in your head when you're watching a movie is unique to you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll say it's like, it's an interesting way of getting around to talking to our guests about who they are without asking the same dopey questions they always get.
And what's interesting, a lot of them are, of course, from, you know, childhood or from early part of my life, but there are a couple that are more contemporary. That's
cool.
Because movies continue to like move me and affect me and
that's good.
Affect the way that I think and create and all that stuff. You know, I love being, surprised by movies. The one I'm pushing now is 1917. You know, I'm like, guys, this movie, this is great cinema, you know, to watch someone pull this off on screen the way Sam Mendes did. I'm just like, yes, yes, yes.
Fantastic.
Give me more of that, please. You know?
I'm actually, no, this is terrible. I saw it in a screening early on, and I was like, I can't wait for the Universal theme park ride.
Yeah.
put your head to the dead germ.
Or wait till 1918 comes out.
Exactly.
Then you got something, right?
Yeah. That's the only thing you do is a sequel, right?
By 1921, it's like, you know what? They're just repeating the same thing over and over.
Well, by 1921, they're just sitting around at home waiting for the next one.
What is this jazz music? What's going on here?
They don't go anywhere.
I have a feeling this is going to end poorly at the end of this.
My God, can you imagine an entire series?
All right, so I'll follow your lead.
Why don't you just start somewhere? And
okay, so
give me a double feature.
Okay,
however you've arranged them, whatever.
Sure, exactly. I just kind of put them in order here. Like I said, there's so many, and you can tell me to shut up at any time. One of the first comedies I saw on the big screen when I was a kid, my dad took us to see it, and the Marx Brothers were having a revival. And I'd never seen the Marx Brothers on the big screen.
This is like early 70s, probably?
Early 70s, like 71 or something like that. And it was Animal Crackers, Duck Soup, and it was playing with My Little Chickadee with W.C. Fields.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, my God. I understood why this was so funny. Like, for the first time, I got it. What film comedy really is when you hear that audience laughing
crowd,
in all the right places. And Animal Crackers was the one that caught my imagination more than anything because it was the Marx Brothers at their pure Marxian.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not their best film. You know, some people say it's probably Duck Soup or Night at the Opera. You know,
it's up there though.
But it's catching them at their best. You know, they had done this on stage. Georges Kaufman wrote it. It's Groucho at his grouchoiest, Chico at his Chicoiest, you know, Harpo. It's all four Marx Brothers just being the Marx Brothers in the best way possible. I remember I was having surgery when I was in high school, this years later, and I used to have a little tape recorder and I would record TV shows. This is before VCRs and stuff, and I would just listen to them.
Right.
And I remember I had the whole movie memorized, and I remember I was going to surgery and I'm going out and I'm doing all the dialogue from Animal Crackers as I'm going out, as like a safety. Oh, hang on, Larry, hang on, wait, Animal Crackers will save you, you know. But it's how I fell in love with the Marx Brothers was through Animal Crackers. So, and it has some of the most classic lines, you know, from Groucho and Chico, all the lines to remember, you know. Yesterday, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got my pajamas, I don't
I'll
know.
Never know. Yes.
And then we tried to move the tusk. The tusk. You try that, it's very hard. Of course, in Alabama, the Tuscaloosa, but that's entirely irrelevant to what I was trying to say. You know, and he would just go on and on in circles, you know. And so the Animal Crackers is the first comedy that I fell in love with on the big screen.
Oh, that's fantastic. I think my first Marx Brothers was... I had a memorable experience at Night at the Opera because I ended up going into the hospital for what they thought was appendicitis that night. And they finally figured out it was simply I had laughed so hard. I had bruised my stomach muscles.
Right.
And that only could happen with the Marx Brothers. So.
Yeah, and Groucho, I mean, he really had these long stretches, and he would just went after Margaret Dumont. It was so amazing. He says, welcome, I'd like to welcome you to my poor home. So, oh, it isn't so bad. In all this, wait a minute, I think you're right, it is pretty bad. As a matter of fact, it's one of the frowsiest looking joints I've ever seen. Where'd you get your wallpaper? You're letting this place run down, and what's the result? You're not getting the class of people that you used to. Why are you getting people in here now that look like you? I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put up a sign under new management. We'll set up a 75-cent meal that'll knock their eyes out. After we knock their eyes out, we can charge them anything we want to. Now sign right here, madame, and give me your check for $1,500. And with this insurance policy, you afford it for your young ones and for your old age, which would be here in a couple of weeks now, if I'm any judge of horse flesh. Now it's time the war said to speak. It's the captain's voice. She finally interrupts it. And I'm like, and my brain is saying, what did I just watch? What was he saying? You know? There was just nothing funnier. So Animal Crackers. There you go.
No, he was a god. Have you ever read Harpo's book?
Of course.
Oh, okay.
Harpo Speaks.
I mean,
absolutely.
That is one of my favorite all-time Hollywood memoirs.
Yes, and Bill Marx, who was Harpo's son,
right.
I met once years ago, and I would see him at certain things around town. There was this guy who did a night with Groucho or something like that. I can't remember who it was, and Bill Marx was there. Got to talk to him. It was cool. He had kind of the link to the Marx Brothers or whatever. Yep. I think he wrote a book too. I can't remember.
I think he did. Yes, about his dad.
And Groucho's son wrote one called Son of Groucho. Yep. You know, which, you know, had some interesting things.
I'm sure.
Yeah, Harpo apparently was just the nicest one out of all.
Well, yeah, and he knew everybody.
Yeah,
I guess there was that. I don't know. There's one of the stories I just always love. There's a story like him and a buddy they haven't seen is at Kaufman in years.
Yeah,
and they fly all the way to like New York and some island off the coast, and their friends are playing croquet, and Harpo and his buddy decide it'll be a big joke. They haven't seen this guy in a year. They sneak onto his island. They take off all their clothes.
Yeah.
They wait for them to get near them on the croquet field. They jump out naked and go boo, run back to the boat, take the boat back to the mainland, get on an airplane and fly back to California.
That's hilarious. Yeah, they liked surprising people naked. They did that. They did that to Irving Thalberg, actually, when he was late for a meeting. So they took off all their clothes and I think they're roasting marshmallows in his office or something like that. Naked. You know, that was the last time he
was. Could you imagine doing that today?
Oh, God. Like, hey, Bob Iger's late. Okay, I'll show you Bob Iger. I'm just going to take my pants off and sit right on this desk over here. I don't think that's the definition of Disney Plus.
Yeah. Hey, remember Larry Wilmore? The guy who, he was great.
He was awesome. What happened to him? He's in showbiz gulag. So my doubleheader with Animal Crackers is A Hard Day's Night.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Now, that's a beautiful.
Now, Hard Day's Night, I, you know, grew up with the Beatles around me, but didn't really listen to the Beatles that much. You know, my parents were into soul music. You know, I heard my father had a huge collection of 45s and he was into jazz and that sort of thing. You know, you hear the pop music around you, but it didn't mean anything to me as a kid. When John Lennon passed away, though, I remember my brother had a tape of the Beatles live at the Hollywood Bowl. And I listened to it and hearing the audience, you know, just go crazy. And I was like, oh, man. And it just brought me back. And I remembered, you know, how big they were. But it didn't dawn on me how big they actually really were.
Yeah.
And I was captivated. And so I decided to do a deep dive. And I went album by album and listened to the Beatles, you know. And I instantly fell in love. I became like the biggest Beatles fan, you know.
That's great.
Ever, you know. And then I got to see Hard Day's Night on the big screen once again.
How old are you?
This is in my 20s.
Early
20s, right. I saw Hard Day's Night. But I was into the music, into the Beatles then, you know, and saw it on the big screen. And I was like the Marx Brothers, it's just the Beatles being the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's not, there's no plot or anything, you know, it's Dick Lester doing kind of a fake documentary type of thing. You know, they're at their most charming, they're at their most Beatly, you know. And it holds up today. You watch A Hard Day's Night. It still has its charm and hasn't lost any of it. It sounds
it's got amazing energy.
It's fantastic, you know? Yeah. And, so there you go. Hard Day's Night.
Could you imagine somebody walking in?
And they were called the Marx Brothers in one of the reviews, actually.
Oh, were they really? That makes sense. That makes perfect sense. I'm just thinking of like somebody actually seeing a double feature of those two movies who was not familiar with either of them.
Yes, exactly.
How that would, imagine, you know, just as you take in the Marx Brothers.
Yeah.
Now you get the Beatles.
I know. So interesting. Okay. So my second double feature.
Oh, right? Okay. Yes.
Okay. So, you know, I'm into political stuff. So one of my early influences was the Manchurian Candidate.
Oh, okay.
Now I saw this
film.
Yeah. Well, this is a John Frankenheimer. Mm-hmm. And the movie was fascinating to me because it was this mix of media, mixing television and film and looks and this conspiracy about brainwashing and the Cold War and Angela Lansbury in a haunting role where she plays Lawrence Harvey's mom and she was only like a few years older than him or something, you know. Yeah, you know. And this whole thing about brainwashing and, you know, you don't think what they set up is going to happen, that this assassination, you don't think it's going to happen. And then when it does, and the way it explodes on screen and all it's just black and white glory, it's it's just interesting to me. And what it said about politics and, you know, it had so many comments that were so ahead of its time, such a smart film. And Frank Sinatra pulled the film after the Kennedy assassination because he was, you know, one of the producers of it. And it didn't resurface till I saw it like 20 something years later.
Yeah. You know, I remember when it came back.
Yeah.
You'd heard about this film.
That's when I saw it. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Yeah. You know?
He's so good in it too. It's
Sinatra, low-key underrated actor. Yeah. You know, From Here to Eternity, of course, he won the Oscar for. Manchurian Candidate, really understated performance, but was really, really good in that, you know. He held that movie together, you know, his determination in there and everything.
There's a funny thing in that film, and I love it.
He took it seriously,
There's that moment, Joe and I have talked about it a little bit in the past, the moment on the train when he's sitting there having the sweats, trying to light a cigarette. He's sitting in a corner, sweating and shaking and not able to light a cigarette.
Right, right.
And Janet Leigh, across the train, looks at him and goes, ooh, I must have that.
Yes. Exactly. Very bizarre, kind of.
But you buy it, kind of.
Yeah, they almost do this pickup scene. That's a very bizarre pickup scene. You know,
But that's about star power to some extent.
Yes, exactly. You know, Sinatra made that movie happen, of course. Yeah. Lawrence Harvey, I never knew what to do with Lawrence Harvey. He was one of those actors. I don't think he let you like him for whatever reason.
Which is why he's so good.
He didn't seem to care, too, you know. Yeah. Which is interesting. But the haunting of Angela Lansbury in that, I'll never forget, you know, and the Queen of Hearts and all that kind of stuff, you know. But it was such a smart film about politics and the different sides and everything. It's one of the first films that I knew that they were taking sides, right versus left, and that type of thing.
Yeah. And commenting on them.
Not afraid to take those sides too, because remember, they were just out of the blacklist at that time, McCarthy era and all this stuff, and they were commenting on that. 1962.
Yeah.
That's pretty brave. Yeah. You know, I don't think Trumbull had come out of hiding yet. I think he wrote Spartacus, you know, in the dark or something.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's right. Yep.
That's that point or something. So I pair that up with the Parallax View.
Oh, well, okay. Sure. Yeah.
Now this is the other conspiracy movie. That one ends with an assassination. The Parallax View starts with an assassination, you know? And this is what's interesting about the Parallax View. It takes us into the world of conspiracy itself. You know, and this is for anybody that's ever thought the JFK assassination and all these things are conspiracies and what goes behind them. You know, this was one of those movies that, again, was lost for a while, like Manchurian Candidate, wasn't around for a while, and then it resurfaced. And I was like, well, what was it? You know, at that time, I was like, I was inviting conspiracies, let's say. You know, I'm like, why was this film away for so long? But who knows? But to me, it's another one of those low-key, great Warren Beatty performances where he's so naturalistic in it. That's what I love about it. They have this fight scene where he punches the guy and he immediately goes, ah, fuck. Yeah. Like he hurts his hand, which is really what would happen in something like that, you know? But, you know, to see him go find out the small company that supposedly is doing something and he goes to this indoctrination and all that kind of stuff. Real interesting. I thought it was the most intelligent take on that type of subject in that real 70s low-key, you know, kind of a naturalistic vein that the 70s movies were. And Paul Prentice, fantastic in a role that was very small. Yeah. Fantastic in that role. I mean, that scene with her and Warren Beatty, she breaks my heart in it. And it almost looks like an actor not listening to the other actor. Like, because I've been in many acting classes, it almost looks like she's saying, stop it! You fucking listen to me! Like, she almost says it like that, and he goes, oh, shit, I guess I'm not listening to you. That's what it almost plays like.
Right.
But, you know, to, yeah, their credit. So anyhow,
I watched that. I don't know. The thing that stuck out to me the last time I saw it, because obviously it's a great film, is this moment. And I've seen it many times over the years, but somehow it just jumped out. So there's a scene where Beatty's following a guy into an airport.
Sure.
And then they cut and he's getting on the airplane.
Yes.
And, you know, they don't
show you. He pays for the flight on the plane.
Well, I was saying, you're like, obviously they cut the part where he bought the ticket. Yes, and then the stewardess walks out and goes, where are you going? Yes, he goes, Baltimore. And he hands her 30 bucks and she hands him a ticket.
That'll be 42,
and he just walked
35.
On the plane.
Yes. Shows you what security was like. Yeah, not too hard to get a bomb in that plane, I guess. You know, like, why were they shocked somebody was able to get a bomb on it?
It's so crazy. And now you got to take your shoes off.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I love watching movies where you see what things were like at that time.
Yep.
You know, movies that give you kind of a view on times. Because it's so much fun learning about. There's so many things that I think are lost in time because only the big things are preserved.
Yeah.
And you lose, like, little things that a saying people might have been doing or, you know, sometimes I'll search for old movies and I'll look on the walls of what the art directors put on it sometimes.
Yeah, to see what,
like what people chose to, what little knickknacks they chose to have, those types of, because those things are lost.
No, exactly. And, when you're saying that, I'm thinking like, it's really fascinating too, to look at stuff, you know, because I was a child when Parallaxia came out, but I was alive.
Yeah.
Obviously my parents took me on a plane. Mm-hmm. As a child, where they bought a ticket on the plane. I don't remember that at all. That's the weird part. When you see stuff from a time where you existed and it feels that alien.
And Parallax View had a comment on America that was kind of similar to Manchurian Candidate, but done in a very artistic way with the whole collage film that they showed.
Yeah, that thing's amazing.
It's very, very interesting. So there you go.
Double feature.
Double feature.
Right. So far, I'm in for all of these. Yeah.
All right. This one is going to be a little bizarre.
Even better.
This would never be a double feature, but it's my double feature. Okay. Starts with one of my all-time favorites, Singing in the Rain.
Okay.
Okay. It might surprise some people why it's one of my favorites, but there's something about Gene Kelly singing that song. And even when I say it right now, it just does something to me. It just transports me. It's comfort food. It's hope and melancholy all in the same thing. Every verse is that. Hope and melancholy at the same time, you know. Make them laugh, you know, the Donald O'Connor song, you know, fantastic. I like that it's about showbiz, you know, that it looks back at the sound and all that stuff.
But they're
funny.
They're
it makes
so,
me laugh. I mean, Debbie Reynolds at her best.
They're all magic.
You know,
I mean, they're so far beyond.
It's true movie magic, you know. And I'm not a big musicals fan. I do like musicals, but something about Singing in the Rain. Whenever it's on TV and it's that song, I picked this out because the song itself just does something to me. And when I see Gene Kelly do that, and it's not that Gene Kelly was the best singer or something. You know, he had 103 degree fever when he did that.
Really?
Yeah, he was really sick when he did that. And so maybe that was it. But there's something about the timbre of his voice that gets me.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, what the fuck is going on here? It doesn't have that. It's not one of my, I wouldn't pick it out. But that is the thing that does it for me. Whenever they show it in collages, I go, there it is.
it's a lovely classic film. It's a great time. Does your other film feature that song?
Yes. And it is A Clockwork Orange. Once again, it features
Singing
in the Rain.
And does the song
have
the same effect on you?
It has a different effect.
I would hope so.
But I find the use of the song as fascinating as the use of the song in Singing in the Rain.
Interesting.
Clockwork Orange, which is Kubrick's dystopian masterpiece about the future based on the Anthony Burgess novel, which if you read the Anthony Burgess novel out there, if you guys haven't read it, you should really read it if you're a fan of the movie. It's really fascinating. And it goes into detail about the Droogs and all that kind of stuff.
Well, the language in it, too.
Yeah, the language is the best. Yeah,
by the end of it, you almost speak.
Yes. Vidi well, little brother, vidi well. You
know? Omi Droogs.
So Gene Kelly singing in the Rain, and now Malcolm McDowell singing in the Rain. You know, point counter fucking point. You know,
you get farther.
Yes. So imagine me loving Singing in the Rain and singing Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
And not knowing that that's
not
coming. Yes. And now it's like, can I even like this song anymore? You know, it's like, what am I going to do with this? Thank you, Kubrick. Now, the movie, of course, Clockwork Orange, I love it for many different reasons, you know.
Love.
But. Oh, absolutely. It's in my top 10 of all time favorites because it dares to be exactly what it is.
Oh, no, for sure.
It's brutal in ways that movies can't be brutal anymore. And
it's true.
It's and by brutal, I mean the honesty of its approach and what it's doing. And Kubrick had a brutality about his storytelling, you know, That was very interesting. You know, I have a couple of his films on my list, you know, for obvious reasons. But, and in fact, he even had a brutality in the way that he shot. He'd do like 60 takes, yeah. you know, 70 yeah. takes. He would crush people, you know.
But I mean, I'm with you in that it's a film I go back to. It's a film I just have a, it's interesting. I don't know if I have the wherewithal to say I love it and it's a favorite.
Yeah, I
you
do.
Feel sort of, I but have, it's, you know, I've watched it a lot more than a lot of movies. No, I like a
when,
lot.
It got me when I saw it. I knew I was going to be stuck with that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, I mean, and I love the, I love stuff that, there's no safe space to hide in that film. There's
right.
nowhere to go where you can go. I'm better than this.
Well, and the movie's about something too. I mean, yeah. a movie about evil,
yeah.
you know, and what do you do with evil? I mean, really, honestly, what do you do with it? And is it up to us to try to change that? And can you? You know, and who wins?
And then the whole question know? Of like, is sustain, you know, now yes. there's a systemic evil and there's this yes. individual evil and
government, all this, but also who wins?
Yeah.
you know,
yeah. yeah.
It's like, is a blow at the end too, you know, yeah. and all that, which is kind of fascinating. And you root for him in the way that we root for Tony Soprano too. So, yeah. so what are we really watching here?
Well, that's a great you know? Comparison. I'm yeah. actually weirdly, my wife and I are going back and rewatching Sopranos,
yeah.
which I have not done in a long time.
Right.
And
brutal.
But in much the
Tony,
same way.
Tony Soprano's
great,
brutal.
Well, the great thing about yeah. it is that they fuck with you. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They'll go episode after episode. And you'll be like, oh, you're rooting for, oh, he's trying. And then they'll show you Tony doing something so fucking
right.
horrible. And it's done in a way that implicates you.
Yes.
Which, you know, kind of Clockwork Orange sort of does the same
does.
Thing. I mean, these are movies and TV shows that make you engage and make you be responsible.
You signed up to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I love. But I also love the fact that it works for people who don't get that at all. There's
yes.
people that are like, oh, I love he popped that guy. He shot him.
I know.
It's like, that's all right. By the way, that's where the money is.
You're absolutely right. No, that is one of the wisest things I've ever heard. You are absolutely right. You know, for me, I'm loving it on a whole nother level,
right.
you know, but I get it. If it doesn't have the, yeah, I like when they showed those tits yeah. on that girl, she came
exactly.
out.
Exactly. Well, I remember right, seeing Unforgiven mm-hmm. in theaters, and when they shoot the guy in the outhouse,
mm-hmm.
there were like two guys behind me who were like, fuck yeah. And you're like, yeah. oh, you idiots. And I saw it again yeah. a couple weeks later, and same scene, a couple guys like, fuck yeah. And I remember going,
yeah.
This is why this movie's going to be a hit.
Absolutely. You know, you need that. Movies yeah. have to connect.
Yeah. And it doesn't yeah. have to worry. It doesn't, you don't have to get every level of it.
Something for everybody.
Something for everyone.
That's
yeah.
what makes the great movies great. Right?
I like yeah. seeing people shot in a bathroom.
yes. Okay. So my next doubleheader are two escape movies, I like to call them.
Okay.
First one. This had another effect on me. I once again saw this as a child. Another one of the first movies I saw on the big screen, Planet of the Apes. Planet of the Apes, I'd never seen anything like that. Couldn't yeah. believe what it was. Of course, it's a morality tale,
yeah.
you know. And, you know, people have seen it right now, so it's not spoilers or anything. But the fact that they're actually on Earth,
yeah,
you know, I'm like, what? you know, I was crushed by it. Me, the young Larry, of course, saw race all in it as well. I'm like, how come the light-skinned apes, you know, are better than the dark-skinned apes?
Yeah.
you know, this type of thing. You know, and
well,
there
it gets weird, too, when you get yeah. into, like, Conquest, where they are using it to make
yes,
it kind of...
Exactly.
And they're on the right side of the thing, but they're still using monkeys to be... The, it's
right. yeah. And my brother, we noticed the darker they were, the more militant they were and
yeah.
everything too, which was kind of interesting. So
do you know about you must know about the dining.
No.
So I think actually Alan Spencer's the first guy who told me about this when they were making
film. Alan knows everything about
Planet. Yeah, no, he's a huge fan. Yeah. But yeah. when they were making the film, they found over the course of time, you know, normally it's like your stars would eat together and your
right.
extras would eat together. They found out that over time, chimpanzees would eat with the other chimpanzees. Oh, the orangutans would eat with the orangutans.
Yes, that's hilarious.
Regardless of, like, you know, their name.
Man is evil, capable of nothing but destruction. Dr. Zaius. Great character. So, you know, a movie about, you know, people that escape Earth only to find themselves back on Earth.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know? So I pair that with another escape movie, which is one of my favorites when I saw it and really affected me profoundly, was Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which to me is Spielberg's purest movie.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of sketched it out when he was a kid. He was a teenager, I think. And it was something that he was mulling for a long time. It's his most original film, I think.
Yep.
You know, you could say at his most Spielbergian, but he hadn't done E.T. yet, you know? So not, he hadn't quite reached those heights. People thought he might've been a one-hit wonder with Jaws during this time. It's a huge risk to do Close Encounters. But to me, Close Encounters was such an unusual film because now here was a movie where, you know, we have people visiting Earth and a man who has a family, has kids. He escapes from Earth. He leaves Earth. It doesn't make sense. No.
That's a great point.
I don't, by the way, I don't think Spielberg writes that ending today.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's interesting, as a young man, I had no problem with it. But as a grown man, I have a huge problem with
it. Yeah. No, I mean, now that you're asking me to think about it, I'm there. I'm
look at my head. Nope.
Yeah.
No. Nope. Doesn't make sense. But
you have kids.
Yes.
That's why Larry's kids, he is shaking his head.
I might send my kids off. Sometimes you feel that way.
No, that's fine. I've not seen
it
in a long time.
To leave your small, this man loved his family. But this movie is fascinating because you see the evolution of this individual that is compelled to do something that he doesn't even know that he has to do.
Yeah.
You know, and he's on this journey and there's this escape hatch that is there for him to leave.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know it's there and he has to go do it. And he doesn't know why. And he's heartbroken about it as well. He's heartbroken about it. When he's building the thing in his room, he's not frustrated. He's heartbroken. And those are two different emotions, you know? And I don't think, if you talk to Dreyfuss, I don't think he would have suggested it was that when he was doing the scene, you know, but that's how it comes across, you know? And if you look at what the arc of this character is, you know, this man's going to leave.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
He's getting ready to go.
You can't just say he tacked that on. No, motherfucker. That's the end of the movie.
That's where the movie is going.
Yes. It's not, okay, they land. We communicated. Yay, movie's over. No. The end of the movie is he leaves, and he leaves everybody.
Yeah.
That to me is like, nobody talks about that ending. People are like, well, they did the alternate one. We could see the inside of the ship. Fuck the inside of the ship. He's on it.
He's on it.
That's what the ending is.
That's, I've not, you know, again, have not seen many, but it never occurred to me as I watched it or saw it again. But yeah, when you say that, it's one of those, I don't know, does it ruin the film? I don't know if it ruins
it. But it's a two fascinating movies about escape.
Yeah.
You know?
But it is an interesting, I don't know, I'm fascinated by stuff like that where, you know, there's just, you see a thing in a movie and now you can't see it the same way again.
It's funny when you look at it a certain
way. I don't know, mine completely different, but the Stepford Wives always drives me because, we talked about this everywhere, but the premise being, we build these robots, they are perfect replicas of humans. We can make one look like, you know, an idealized version of your wife. She will do all the chores. Right. She will do everything you want to do. She'll cook for you. She'll take care of you. Mm-hmm. She'll perform any sexual act, no matter how degrading. She'll whatever.
Why are you mad at that?
Right. That's great. You're like, okay. And to get her, you have to kill your real wife.
Mm.
Why? They never explain why you have to.
Yeah.
It's, and I've discussed this with my wife and she's agreed. If we could get that thing, we would get it now. It'll be fine. It'll be amazing. I'll be like, what are we having for dinner? She's actually, don't ask me, ask the fucking robot.
We're not too far away from that now, you can get
it. But the part where they have to kill it's like, you just got the best vacuum cleaner in the world. Oh, great. Now you have to kill some. Why? They don't explain.
Why is there murder involved?
Why is there murder involved?
I know.
But everyone goes along with it.
Yeah.
Like the ending of Close Encounters. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, just leave it. You got to kill your wife.
Yeah. Really interesting. And you know, things are movies or whatever, you know, but that's not an arbitrary choice for me. Dreyfuss getting on that ship, you know, it's like, if you do that, okay. All right. You just did that.
It's been so long. Where, at what point his wife and kids sort of drop out of the film about halfway through.
And the thing is, he's compelled to just leave. There's nothing he can do about it. But what they did in that scene where they have her really upset at him and she leaves, says, I'm leaving you. You know, and she takes the kids.
Yeah.
But it's not really resolved.
Yeah.
They're still really in the middle of a fight.
And they're not, it's not like they show up at the end and watch him go.
No.
Because that would have.
Not at all. And the woman that he's with, she gets reunited with her son. That's closure.
That's right.
That's completing the circle.
Yeah.
She lost him. That's how the normal movie would have done.
Yeah.
So this other thing that Spielberg puts in is, I don't know what to do with that, you know, because. Why is that there? You know,
I'm trying to tap into sort of my, because I remember.
But like I said,
wow.
I guarantee you, I can't guarantee. But if Steven Spielberg was here right now and say, would you write it that way today?
No, absolutely
I bet
not.
He'd say no.
Absolutely not.
You know, because he's a father now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Because that is, because there is that sense. Yeah. I remember watching it where you're like, oh, good, she got her kid back.
Yeah.
And oh, good, he's getting to finally go on this adventure.
Right.
And, you know, I'm whatever, a kid when I'm watching the film.
If it was just a tour of the ship, fine.
Yeah. But it doesn't occur to me as a, you know, whatever it was, a teenager that like, yeah, he's leaving anything behind that you wouldn't
want. It's not like a space Uber or something, right. You know, it's just going to take him. It's a shortcut to his house if he gets in this big thing, you know.
Yeah.
I know it took a while to get to the mountain. I know. So we're just going to give you the.
Oh, my God, that's so funny. Yeah, that's so funny. I have to watch it again and think about that some more.
There you go. Okay. Next doubleheader is just, This doubleheader is about individuals that just make me laugh. Okay. The Party.
Ah.
Underrated movie, not talked about too much. It's Peter Sellers just making us laugh.
Problematic
the party is.
Now, of course.
Well, now it is problematic. Yeah. You know, he plays an Indian character and he does an accent, but he's so funny in it. Yeah. I mean, Peter, it's like they just turned the camera and said, Mr. Sellers, could you just make us laugh?
Go nuts.
And it's just Peter Sellers at a party. There's no plot to it. There's nothing. And, you know, he's just saying funny things, doing funny things. And for a long time, I would tell people, you have to watch The Party. It's just the funniest thing in the world, you know. And it just, I would cry laughing just watching it, you know. And Peter Sellers has done many funny things. But The Party, to me, was somebody say, you know what? I think it was Blake Edwards who did it, right? So you know what?
Cut him loose.
We just need a movie where you're just funny. there's nothing else. You know? All this plot and all that shit, it just gets in the way. We just need you to be funny.
Yep.
Are you up for that? Okay.
Yeah, sure. It's true. Yeah, but yeah, it is. It's that weird thing of the, you know, it's that era where you could just paint him brown and have him do a funny accent, and everyone is fine with that.
Yeah, that's right.
And what's weird is the film. That's the interesting, you know, as I think about it, there's nothing about his character that requires that.
No.
Because I could see almost, you know, we've got this great script. It's about this Indian guy saying, look, you know, the only guy who can play that is Peter. Yeah. What are we going to do? I don't know. We make him Indian. They don't have to.
Yes. And the character, he was so innocent and he was trying to do the right thing, but he was so bumbling. It was in that era of bumbling comedy, like Get Smart and that type of thing, you know. And, you know, slapstick in the movie is very funny.
Yeah. Well, when they were good, I don't know. I just watched and I was really anxious about it because a lot of comedy doesn't age well and a lot of times.
Right.
And I have a weekly movie night, a bunch of friends. I was like, we're just going to do it because it was the first movie I ever saw on my own, Return of the Pink Panther.
Oh, yeah.
And oh, my God.
That was when they came back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It holds.
Yeah.
Up. We were dying.
Yeah. There's some good slapstick in there. Yeah.
Amazing slapstick.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I got to see The Party again. It's been a while. Right. But.
Does your dog bat? No, my dog's not. Oh, that's not just a dog, it's not bat. That's just not my dog. Oh, yes, I know that. It's very good. Yeah, Return of the Pink Panther, classic stuff in there. Kato.
Yeah.
And Pink Panther Strikes Again.
There's some good stuff in that one, but it doesn't quite. Because after that, it felt like that one sort of came out of the blue.
Yeah.
And then it was like, now we got to make more of them. And they didn't quite have the.
Yeah.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
So I pair that with another movie that it was risque at the time, you know, I guess you could say, but was the first concert movie that I saw, and that was Richard Pryor live in concert.
Oh, wow.
This is another movie where it's just one guy just making me laugh.
Yeah.
You know, it's a concert stand-up movie, but it's the best of all time.
Yeah.
Nothing can touch it. Yeah. And it's just Richard Pryor just being funny.
Yep.
You know what, Richard Pryor, we just got to put you on film and you just got to do your shit, man. You just got to make us laugh.
Yeah.
I'd never seen a concert movie in the theaters before.
I'm trying to think, had there been?
I don't remember one.
I mean, there have been some musical guys, but like a stand-up comedian?
I don't remember. I think it was the first.
That feels, yeah.
There have been many after, but I'd never seen one before.
Yeah.
And so to me, just to sit in that movie theater and laugh at Richard Pryor for an hour and a half, I mean, I couldn't breathe. You know, it was amazing to me, you know. And I had an 8-track of it, I remember too, fantastic. Of the concert. And it was a little different than the one in the movie. They used a different performance. So
oh, really?
Like,
oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting.
Oh, especially if you're up and coming comic. That's got to be.
Well, I didn't know I was going to be at that point.
Right.
Even though I thought about it, but didn't know if I could. But
that's, when, it's working in your brain.
Well, yeah, but I would see that and I go, there's no way I could be this funny. You know, this guy's way too funny. Just can't, you know.
Yeah. Now I wish Joe would know. He's probably like, there's some. Well, it was a Bob Hope live in concert from 1952.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Yeah, but yeah, no, the thing, because I was a kid when that came out. And, you know, I heard the records, but there was no way I could at my age and various other things. You know, I wasn't going to be able to go see Richard Pryor perform live
in
Philadelphia
either.
Anywhere. You know,
I couldn't go see it.
It was an amazing opportunity.
And it was Pryor at his best.
Yeah.
You know, it was before the fire.
Yeah.
You know, it was, he was just at it. He was never better than that.
Yeah.
You know, so Rich Pryor live in concerts, well, he does the thing about his dogs and the monkeys and the heart attack, you know, and he's on the ground talking about the heart attack, you know, all of this stuff. It was just the bravest thing I'd ever seen, you know. When I think of stand-up, I can't think of stand-up without thinking of Rich Pryor live in concert. Yeah. If I'm asked to think about what's the greatest and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, where would that art form be?
He and Carlin pushed it to that next level, you know, with what they did in the 70s. It really gave people permission to just be raw, you know, and not be afraid to just tackle those subjects that.
But he wouldn't. I mean, I love Carlin and there was the whole, but Pryor had this, he was all naked.
Yeah,
you
know, it was wrong.
Carlin never told you his worst shit.
No.
And
he told us our worst shit.
Yeah, absolutely. No, good point. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And in a way, it's a great, you need them both.
Yes, that's exactly right. You know, he commented on us, you know.
Yeah.
But Pryor, you know, he grew up in a brothel. His grandmother was a madam, you know, and he did a concert film that was underground called Richard Pryor Live and Smoking. That he did years before, but it wasn't like this. And he talked about like giving guys blowjobs and that kind of stuff. And you could see the, cause he wasn't like the big Rich Pryor. Now he's like, I don't know if we want to, and he was in a small club. It wasn't like a big concert type of thing. It looked like he was like in the belly room of the Comedy Store or something like that, you know? And then he's like, nope, we're not ready for this, Richard. Nope. Not sure if we're ever going to be ready for you to tell us this, you know, different generation. You know?
I remember being so when he finally made what was it, JoJo Dancer?
Yeah.
I was so disappointed. It was like there was an opportunity there. I thought
it's tough to do.
It's an impossible.
It's hard to recreate stand up in a movie. I don't know if anyone's ever really done it.
One of the things get far afield, but that's what we do. One of the things that knocked me out about Dolemite was. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd heard that Rudy Ray Moore stuff and, you know, like a lot of stuff like Lenny Bruce, you listen to Lenny Bruce today and you're like, no, he was funny. You have to understand that.
Yes.
And Eddie's doing verbatim Rudy Ray Moore bits that if I played right now would just land with a thud. And I thought he somehow brought him to life.
Well, see, the difference is you had Dustin Hoffman trying to play Lenny Bruce, and Lenny Bruce is funnier than Dustin.
Oh, well,
Hoffman.
Yeah.
Good. Just, but you have Eddie Murphy playing Rudy
funnier
Moore,
than
Eddie
Rudy.
Murphy is funnier than
that's
Rudy
right.
Moore. So that's why good we're point. Laughing at Eddie doing it, and you listen to it, go, I don't know if the original is all that good. Now that Eddie's done it, thanks, Eddie.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of the irony of those. You know, Lenny Bruce did a routine called How to Make a Negro Feel Comfortable at a Party or something like that, you know, he did on television.
But I feel like that stuff, like when I laugh at Lenny Bruce stuff, I'm laughing because I'm remembering being like 9 and finding those records and thinking they were hilarious then.
Right.
But like, I know if I play them for like a 25-year-old
because it's gone so far past that. A lot of the stuff he talked about, they laughed because you couldn't believe he was talking about it.
Right.
You know, and since it's gone, so the shock is gone. So it has, if it's, you know, if the jokes aren't good or aren't as sophisticated as we like now, you're like, and you know who, interestingly enough, can still make me laugh. Is some of the early Jerry Lewis television stuff that he did with Dean Martin because it's just slapstick.
Right.
You know, and I can't believe he's being that crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, oh my God, this guy, he was really crazy. Like if you look at the Texaco Star Theater and some of that stuff that they did, Jerry Lewis is out of his mind.
Yeah, that helps.
He's out of his mind.
But it's surreal.
And it's pure funny. And you see, okay, Jim Carrey came from this. There's so many comics that came from that type of expression that, you know, we just forgot. Look, I wasn't alive then, but he was so just pure funny, and that's all it was, just a ball of funny. And it's still funny. If you watch it, you go, you cannot not laugh, you know? Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
All right. You ready for the next one?
Sure. Do the next one.
Okay. I got a few more.
Awesome.
Okay. These two movies, this doubleheader, you shouldn't be watching these two movies.
Okay? Either of them?
You should not be watching.
At all.
Well, there is a price to be paid for watching.
Is one of them Human Centipede?
No, but that's interesting. Okay, the first one is...
That's interesting.
The first one is Lolita.
Okay.
Okay.
That's an amazing film.
Stanley Kubrick film, of course. Nabokov novel. In the novel, you know, it's a movie about this man who marries this woman and he's lusting after her teenage child. I think in the book she was 12.
Well, she's 12. In the movie, she's 16.
She's 16, which still...
Like that made a difference.
We're not supposed to be watching a movie about incest.
Yeah.
We are not supposed to be watching that, and we are not supposed to be enjoying it, and we're not supposed to be putting ourselves in James Mason's place. Right. We're not supposed to be doing any of those things, yet we are doing all of those things.
Yes.
And there's a tremendous amount of guilt when you're watching that movie, knowing that I really shouldn't be enjoying this movie and watching it, but it's really fucking good.
It's an amazing film.
It's an amazing film. Yeah. I mean, he really, I don't know how he got away with it. I don't know how he was able to make that movie in 1961, 62.
Oh, because it'd be so easy to make today.
I don't even know if you can make it. You can't make it today.
No, you can't.
There's no period of time, maybe 1973, with Hugh Hefner funding it or something, where you can make that film. Or when Bob Guccione made a
Caligula.
Caligula, right. Where you could have made that. But other than
that. But then she'd still have to be 18.
But the window to make that.
Yeah.
I can't believe that he made that movie. Yeah. And it's excellent.
Yeah.
Peter Sellers in another underrated role.
Yeah. Oh, him on the porch with James Mason
Crazy.
Is my all-time favorite.
Fantastic.
Uncomfortable scene.
If you guys have not seen Lolita, which if you listen to this, I'm sure you've seen all these movies. But Lolita, man.
Yeah.
Wow. And she just passed away. Sue Lyons.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah, she just passed away.
And did you have, every time she showed, because she only showed up in a few films, but I always had this just every time she showed up, I just go,
Yeah. Oh, it's Lolita.
Night of the Iguana.
And
love her.
How great was Shelley Winters?
Shelley Winters is amazing.
Oh, my God.
Because she's
just good.
I want to look up how old she was, and I'm sure she was much younger than you think she was.
Completely.
And she was not at the age where an actress normally would be that comfortable making herself that.
Yes.
It's not even that she's unattractive, because she's not. She's just sort of frowsy and dumpy and needy. And I mean, she just goes to these incredibly bare uncomfortable places.
Yeah. She was she was not a narcissistic.
The cha-cha-cha dance.
Yeah. Oh my God. She was a bear actor.
Yeah.
She was not afraid to look, you know, to be whatever she was.
Yeah.
You know, which was special about her.
Oh, she was amazing. And
especially in those days, you know. She embraced that and was great at it, you know. And the other movie that you should not be watching is The Elephant Man.
Wait, why shouldn't you be watching The Elephant Man?
Because he is on display once again.
Okay.
So David Lynch makes that perfectly clear.
Yeah.
That this man with this problem is put on display for people to, even the people that are there applauding him, he's still on display.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And here I am in the audience watching it, and I go, fuck. Right in the middle of that movie, I remember thinking, fuck you, David Lynch. You know, I'm not supposed to be watching this movie. I'm doing exactly what they're doing.
Right. Yeah. Yes. That's a good point.
You know, he's a spectacle. We have made a spectacle of him again, you know, and what a glorious spectacle. It's a great, it's a fantastic movie, you know, which Mel Brooks produced. A lot of people don't know Brooks films, you know, beautiful score by John Morris. I still, when I hear Deja for Strings, I used to cry all the time back then. That movie moved me. It moved me so much when I saw that, but I had tremendous guilt.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, when I realized, and I remember telling my brother at the time, I said, we're doing the same thing.
Right.
You know, we're not supposed to be. Well, of course, I made a lot of jokes about it, too. You know? Back in the day, I used to do routines about it and all that kind of stuff.
We know better now.
Don't get me wrong.
Yes. You know?
But still, two movies that.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I will feel guilty about Lolita, I guess.
For different reasons.
But no, it's a good point. Have you seen the new David Lynch thing that just dropped?
No.
Do you know, on his birthday, I think it was last week, it's a short film. I can't remember. Jack, somebody, and it's David Lynch playing a cop and he's interrogating a monkey. And it's 20 minutes long.
David Lynch is in it?
Yeah, he's in it and he directed it. And and it just dropped out of nowhere.
What platform is it?
It's on Netflix.
Okay. Is it any good?
It's an amazing David Lynch talks to a monkey for 20 minutes, Larry. What do you think?
It's like an outtake from Blue Velvet or something.
It's a talking monkey, too.
Of course it is.
It's 20 minutes, you'll just want to repeat again, probably.
Very bizarre.
Although my wife hated it.
How much time do you have?
As much time as you need.
Okay, great. Because I have a few more and I'd love to go through them since I wrote them down.
Fantastic.
Okay, so these two movies, I can watch these two movies anytime they're on television, even though I own different versions of them. I can watch it anytime. They're two movies that have stars at the height of their powers, you know, and they're just great movies. First is The Apartment. Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine are the best version of Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, I'm so in love with
I fell in love with both of them.
Yeah.
You know, Jack Lemmon is so endearing. He's so funny. And what's impressive about that is Billy Wilder, who's a German immigrant, able to write comedy in another language, you know, where other people have talked about that more eloquently. I mean, and The Apartment is, I think the period, I mean, Some Like It Hot, of course, is a good example, but that's really farce. You know?
Yeah. No, this is a much more.
Which is great, but this is sophisticated, you know, and it's dark. There's, you know, suicide attempt in it, all these types of things. It's about adultery, you know, but Jack Lemmon's so entertaining and he just takes me on that ride. And Shirley MacLaine is so endearing, you know, and there's such an innocence about it and kind of a nastiness about it at the same time, you know. It's funny, if I watch Mad Men, it makes me think of The Apartment.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, you know? For sure. And, how many movies have you seen where they just, that shot of The Office is just showed up in so many things, of just all those desks. And,
the humor still works in The Apartment. Yep. It's still very funny because, first of all, because of the writing, but also the performances, you know. Jack Lemmon is so funny in it, you know.
Well, you know what's interesting? Think about it, the sexual politics of are not something that... And look, I'm sure you can find elements of it to quibble with today, but they're not something you have to get over to enjoy.
That's exactly right.
He is coming from the, I would argue, if not the correct position, the same position we would be coming at it from
today.
Well,
there is still a little bit of the male ownership of the vagina type of thing.
Right, that's being sort of attacked in a way.
Yes, and he knew that she was going through a tough time too. It wasn't just that some other guy has been in here, I can't get in here, you know, that type of thing. Yeah. So, and... he had a bond with her too. That was that was something else too. And he really wanted to stand up for her and do the right thing, which is good. But you're right. There's nothing that you have to go, you know.
Yeah, some of those things I have to explain to my wife beforehand. Like, you can't just appreciate the fact that they're all sexist pigs. You're like, oh no, it's actually they know that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why the movie works.
Yeah, you know. I wish Joe. This is gotta think Joe would pull out 50 other examples, but I feel like Billy Wilder is the only person who effectively used Fred McMurray as a bad guy.
Well, Double Indemnity, he was a bad guy.
Yeah, yeah. That's Billy Wilder.
Right. That's true.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Another good Wilder film.
Yeah.
How can you write those two movies? That's crazy.
And by the way, this is my I despise the auteur theory. Of course I do. I'm a screenwriter. But, you know, we reward the people who keep making the same movie.
Yeah.
And it's more like Billy Wilder, who could do Double Indemnity and then The Apartment. Well,
and he did collaborate with I.L. Diamond a lot. Yeah.
But he doesn't, you know, he's not, you know, he doesn't get that top tier auteur respect because he did such diverse stuff, you know.
And he was really a craftsman at heart.
Yeah.
He didn't think of himself as this artistic type of thing. You know, he was just making movies. Yeah. You know, he was like, you punch in your card, ching, ching, you know. Yeah. That's the type of attitude he had about it seemed, you know. So the other one in that category is The Sting.
Oh,
you know, The Apartment and The Sting are those two movies. It doesn't matter. I will stop whatever I'm doing and I have to watch it. I'm right in front of the TV. Redford and Newman, once again, at their highest star quality, their most blaring stars. You know, once again, you love both of those guys.
They're good looking men.
The script is unbelievable. No one has made a better movie than The Sting that is a movie like that since. No one.
Yeah.
You know, George Roy Hill. And once again, you know, from Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, which, you know, was great for other reasons. But The Sting, how do you make a polished movie?
Better.
How do you like make such a polished movie and it's so beloved and it's still entertaining and all this stuff? Unbelievable supporting cast.
Robert Shaw.
And an anachronism that works.
Yeah.
The anachronism is Marvin Hamlisch's soundtrack,
which
he uses ragtime music for the
30s.
It's completely the wrong time period. Yep. But you don't go, wait, why is there ragtime? Why is he playing Scott Joplin?
This mostly because most of us are too stupid to know that.
Right, but
I know I am.
But it's not 1915.
You're right.
It's the Depression. Nobody was listening to Scott Joplin during the Depression. It doesn't make sense.
But this anachronism works
in a way that the 30s music maybe might have made it ordinary.
Yeah.
It's an amazing anachronism, you know?
Yeah.
It's one of the things I really love about it is the Scott Joplin music. And
I'm sure I forgot, but it really
gives it the character that it needs. And I think Hamish at the time played around with different things, but nothing seemed to work like that. And he knew it wasn't right. He knew it wasn't the right time frame. But it's like, what am I going to do? It works.
Yeah.
Dun, 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 dun. I hear those bars and I go, ah! And I gotta watch it.
We're talking about like seeing prior before you knew you were going to be a comic, but yes. That's sort of working on you. When I was a kid, I mean, remember when my dad and I would go to a movie, and if it was sold out, you just go to something next door, and they would let you in the middle.
Right.
Because it would start over again 5 minutes later. Sting, we walked into the Sting about 40 minutes in.
Yeah.
And, and you can pick up what's going on. Oh, no, it's okay. Uh-huh. And you get to the end, and then we watch the beginning. And I think that was one of the first times. And it was one of the first times I ever noticed. It was like, this stuff's constructed.
Yes.
As a child, I'm noticing that they're telling me how the movie's going to end. Yeah. They're laying it out. And if I were smarter, if I paid attention, that ending wouldn't surprise me. They're playing completely fair.
Yeah.
And it's like, but watching all that stuff get laid out as a kid was kind of my first insight to like what goes on under the hood of the car. You know?
Yes. And for me, interesting enough, one of my hobbies growing up was magic. I still do close-up magic and that type of thing. Remember the Magic Castle? Yeah. That type of, I love magic. And Newman is handling cards in there, and the whole gambling. I love that whole thing, where it's that part of the con I just loved, and seeing that type of thing. So many little things in that movie, though. But, and like I said, the supporting cast. And by the way, what's his name? Robert Shaw. I mean, so good in it. Lonergan.
Yes. He's just so mad the whole time.
So many classic things. This was a period of time when my dad used to take us to Universal Studios on a tour, and they'd have pictures of the Sting on the bus, and I would look at thinking, that's what a movie is. And I remember they took us behind the scenes of the Sting and how they did, what's his name, Albert Whitlock, who did the special effects, and that stuck in my head. I go, oh, that wasn't real. So the Sting was one of those first movies that I got to go backstage on and think about and start dreaming about being in movies. So,
interesting. Yeah.
So it has that thing for me. So Sting is up there as one of my all-time favorites.
It's a magical film.
Okay, so this next doubleheader, this is one of my favorites, actually. I call these, I didn't know where to put these, so I stuck them together and thought, let me just come up with something. Because I had the first one with another one, and I thought, like, the first one could be something you're not supposed to watch, you know, in some ways. But I decided to link these together as, let's call it alternate histories.
Okay.
Okay. And the first one is one of my all-time favorites, is The Life of Brian. Okay. And I believe there are some people that will tell you that Holy Grail is their best film. I think Holy Grail has some classic moments, but The Life of Brian is their best film. Because it has a story. It's so subversive. Here I am, a young Catholic kid, watching this takedown of Jesus.
Yeah.
Brian, who grows up next to him. And the humor is so funny. Mm-hmm. And it's political, all the stuff that I love, by the way. Satirical, it's silly.
Yeah.
It has all the elements. It holds up, when you look
Holy
at
Holy Grail's sort of bumpy these days.
Holy Grail doesn't quite hold up.
It's a collection of skits.
It is a collection of skits. And, some of the scenes are, you look at as, that's my favorite scene.
Absolutely.
More than it speaks to you today. It doesn't speak to you today, but it reminds you of that. But Life of Brian, interesting enough, the politics of Life of Brian are still relevant today.
Yeah.
When they argue about things. And say, I think I'm going to be a woman, A woman? Or is it? It's
what have the Romans done for us?
Yes. Well, other than the aqueduct, what are the roses? Or my favorite is a crucifixion. Yes. Okay. Grab the cross. First cross on your left. Go to the crucifixion. Yes. Grab the cross. First thing you left. Crucifixion. No. What? No. Pilate reviewed my case and said I'm able to go free. Oh, okay. Well, you can go. I'm just pulling a leg. Crucifixion. Okay. Grab the cross. First one on your left. Crucifixion? Yes.
Yes.
It's like, what am I watching once again? So you know, good. So this alternate history of the Jesus story, you know, we have all seen the greatest story ever told and all this stuff. This is an alternate history.
Happening down the road.
Do you have any more of that muh? You know, well, don't bring in that muh. You
know? I don't know. I've always, by a moment, Terry Jones just left.
I know. So, I just saw Eric Idle the other night.
Oh,
you know?
Wow.
And I said, hey, I'm really sorry for Finney. He says, well, I'm still here. You know.
I love the way those guys cope with that stuff. They were
so funny.
Shortly after Graham Chapman died, I saw them. They were at some live thing, maybe at Sundance, and they brought him out supposedly on an urn.
Yeah,
and they were Eddie Izzard was talking to them, and they're sitting there with this thing in the air. They're going through like 20 minutes, and then Cleese just crosses his legs and accidentally kicks the urn with Graham Chapman's ashes all over the audience.
That's fantastic.
But for me, it's like the key to existence, the key to everything. I've never identified harder with a character in a movie than the scene where Brian opens up the door and there's that throng out there and he's naked.
Yeah.
And, so fantastic. And he's like going, yo, go away. And they're all like, we love you. And he goes, you don't need me. You're all individuals.
Right.
And they all go, yes, we're all individuals. And then one voice pipes up, I'm not.
Yes, it's so great.
That's my guy. I love that guy.
Oh, it's great. You're all individuals. We're all individuals. You're all separate. We're all separate. I'm not.
Yeah.
Great. So are there any women here?
No.
They go to the stoning. Women weren't allowed at the stoning.
The beards.
Yeah. Are there any women here? Yeah. Just the politics and everything. It's subversive in all the best ways.
So here's like, why do...
Banned in England?
Oh, yeah. Well, I got a lot of heat. I was actually living. I went to high school in England for 1 year, and it was the year that came out.
Yes.
And you can't believe the shit they got. It was incredible.
And they could not get funding for George Harrison.
George Harrison. Guaranteed the movie. Became a producer.
Yes, that's right.
I love that story. Yeah. Because he ended up... That became his whole thing. It was like, he would just produce... He would like, I want to see this movie. So he'd write a check.
I'll make some movies.
And how many great fucking films did he produce?
Time Bandits. A lot of stuff. Yeah.
It's what is it? Because you live in this space. I mean, I go to comedies. I go, they're hilarious.
Right.
I tell jokes to friends.
This is one of my most influential movies, by the way, for me about to start my life doing this.
Oh, wow. So
absolutely.
Why is it? Because we just did it like a bunch of idiots. Everybody does it. You bring up Python.
Yeah.
And you always have to launch into your favorite Python bits. Yeah. It's like, what is that?
They were just funny.
But it's
just
like funny. It's amazing.
It's just funny. By the way, I'm so proud of, I can't take full credit. My ex-wife and I'll take dual credit. But over Christmas, we're hanging out and say, you guys want to watch a movie? And my kids say, let's watch Holy Grail. I haven't seen that one. I'm like, I can't believe my kids are telling me to put on Monty Python. I'm like, how awesome is this? You know, and they know all the bits from it and everything.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's so great.
It's just fun. It really is fun.
Yeah,
you know, the argument sketch, I could do anything. It's so much fun, you know, from their show.
There is, if you're a psycho nerd like me, there's an amazing British Blu-ray box set that just came out where these absolute lunatics have done an incredible job of restoring the TV shows.
Oh.
You've never seen them look so good. You've never seen them sound so good. Wow. It's phenomenal. It's every single episode. Each one comes, they're broken into seasons, and they come with these huge thick books where they've detailed every story behind every skit. And it's because, you know, you saw them on TV. And they always looked okay.
Yeah. They were on PBS.
On PBS. They look phenomenal. Right.
You know what I had back in the 90s, in the big computer days, you know, when screensavers were a big deal, I had this Python screensaver. It was hilarious. Cleese with his silly walks and that stuff.
You could buy that, right?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It was $40 at Radio Shack.
Yeah, exactly. Or Egghead Software.
Egghead Software.
That's where I used to go, man. Okay, so the other movie with alternate history that I love is a contemporary film. It's Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Inglourious Basterds, every frame of that movie is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, but to start that movie off with a scene we've seen a million times, but haven't quite seen it like this, you know, with what's-his-name's performance,
Brad Pitt.
No, in the beginning.
Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz.
Sorry.
I mean, scene. I mean, I've never seen that kind of scene, you know, and I'm thinking, what am I in for as I'm watching that the whole time? Because, you know, when you're in the business stuff, you know, if you're a writer, as you do, you tend to anticipate sometimes.
Sure.
You know? But even though I'm pretty good at jumping in and just being it, but we can't help but you know, really in the back of us kind of having a sense of what's coming.
Yeah.
Like I've guessed lines many times too, yeah. where lines have been boom, and they said exactly what I was thinking. You know, it's kind of interesting. But I had no idea what I was watching.
That's
right
the
now.
Greatest feeling in the world.
It was, and the way that he used, now that film, what's interesting is Python, you know, Life of Brian is a satire of, you know, power and religion and all these things. And this is about war, but it's about how language, you know, was, you know, what made that movie interesting. It was the last war where language was the thing that divided people, because after that, you could tell who's who, mm-hmm. you know, when it's just white people shooting each other.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was language.
Yes.
You know, and the movie is about that.
Right.
That's what it's about.
Right. Because our next war is Korean. And
yes.
We're off
and that whole scene is about language. I mean, yeah. he switches to English, you know, so they couldn't understand him down there. And when they did that, I'm like, whoa, what am I watching? You know, he got me too, because when they showed the people and then he said, I'm going to switch back now. I'm like, oh, motherfucker. And this alternate history, of course, of telling of the hunting of the Nazis, you know, yeah. which was kind of a real thing, but of course it didn't end that way, you know, was I consider it Tarantino's best personally. A lot of people might say Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction is brilliant for a lot of other reasons, but Inglourious Basterds, it's just an amazing alternate history movie to me.
Have you? Really when do you is. Come down on the new one on Hollywood?
It's okay. It's okay. See, the problem is it's an alternate history,
right?
And it's not as good as Inglourious Basterds.
Okay.
It's just not. You
Here's
know?
My question: have you seen it once?
Yes. It says once upon a time.
Yeah. Man. Well, yes. No, Nancy. Yes. I went off and saw it. We were like, oh yeah, that was fun. Although I've never seen her laugh. My wife mm-hmm. does not like ultraviolet movies, but yes. I've never seen her laugh so hard mm-hmm. as at the end. And then for some reason the other night, she was out and I do this, you know, I'm like, smoke a little joint, throw something up on the big screen. And I had a screener of it and I was like, something about it was calling to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you the second time through.
I'll watch it again.
I fucking loved it.
I enjoyed the movie, but the thing I enjoyed about it the most was seeing Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of in my apartment sting category more than, but I don't think it has the intelligence of Inglourious Basterds.
It's way more laid back for sure.
Yeah, but it doesn't have the scene. It doesn't have the scene intelligence of it. You know, mm-hmm. there's nothing going on for a long period of time in that
which,
movie.
Which is a thing I think the second time through you're okay so there's, with.
It's, but there's no tautness to it.
Absolutely.
And the thing about the other one, this is what I mean by every frame is perfect in Inglourious Basterds. Even just the scene of the war hero talking to the girl, you know, when she realizes how many people he's shot and that people are, that's a brilliant scene. The scene where he offers her that's a brilliant scene where Goebbels is, you know, there and he's kind of jealous of how much attention the hero is getting. I mean, there's so many different touches to it, you know, and you don't know how to feel during all of it too. You don't know what's going to happen. Once upon a time in Hollywood, I liked it, but I'm like, okay, what's going on now? When is it going to?
Well, I think, but that's what the thing that, you know, it's weird. I had the same, like, I love the Coen brothers, Big Lebowski. The first time I saw it, hated it. Second time I saw it, I think it's like my third favorite Coen brothers film. Cause
so you part warm of it, up. It takes you a while to warm
up. Well, sometimes part of it is your anticipation because you're watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood going, where's this going? And it really isn't. And then there's the last 5 minutes. You're like, okay. But once you're watching it, knowing that the journey is,
now,
are
you a fan of Inglourious Basterds?
I liked Inglourious Basterds.
Okay,
I love Once Upon a Time.
Okay, so it's a difference in taste then of
maybe,
what you like.
Yeah,
okay,
but I would say see it again because the first time I saw it, I'm completely in your camp.
Yeah,
and the second time, all the things that bothered me about it, I'm now prepared for.
Right.
It's a weird kind of like with Lebowski. My big issue is like, there's no plot. When's the plot? It's going. It doesn't go anywhere.
Sure.
You're like, it's not supposed to. The second time you see it, you're like, oh fuck me.
Yeah, That part doesn't bug me for those things,
yeah.
But it still has to be about something.
Yeah. Oh, I think it is. Know? I think it is finally.
I could have missed that. But like there are some things where they're being a little too leisurely for my taste. You know? And I'm like, okay.
I guess that first time I'm like tapping my watch. A second time I'm going to make it last. Now like, I'm like 5 hour version.
Pulp Fiction is great, but that diner scene is too long.
Uh-huh.
The one where they're dancing and all that stuff.
Oh yeah.
It's too long. Even though the movie's great, you could still cut that scene. You can, and it's still the same movie. That's what I mean. There was nothing happening in there that warranted it being that long. It was just a little bit of indulgence. Just my point of view. Okay, so these next two are movies about the movies in some ways. And they're both of them just mean something to me. And I've always wanted to do my version of this, you know. And the first one involves one of my favorites of all time, Buster Keaton, and it's Sherlock Jr.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that he jumps onto the screen and does this sequence, I was like, once again, being into magic and all that, this is movie magic to me. Sherlock Jr.
Isn't that the dream, too?
It's fantastic. It's just, he takes this fantasy and he lives it in. This is Keaton, to me, I think Sherlock Jr. has to be spoken in the same breath as the general, Steamboat Bill and all that, for its inventiveness and just Keaton just at his best. You know, he has some stunts in there that I still don't know how he did it. This one where he jumps in this window and he's instantly in this costume of a woman or something. You know, it's crazy. You know, and it's just his best gags. But the magical part of that is the projectionist part where he leaves his body and goes into the screen. The cousin to that is The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Rose of Cairo.
Of course, you know, 1980s. Woody Allen movie. Takes that without Woody Allen.
Yep.
Takes that movie to the next level.
Yeah.
You know, Mia Farrow, so great in this movie with Jeff Daniels, who I think was Michael Keaton at first. I think he was cast in this movie at first.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think so. I could be wrong with that.
That was like Jeff Daniels' big break, I think, wasn't it? I feel like that was...
It's possible. It's possible. But such a charming movie, you know, different use of the premise. But once again, you know, then this, if you guys haven't seen it, one of the actors leaves the screen in this, and the other actors refuse to go on because they can't believe it. And the audience is, what? And this
pissed.
Woman who goes to this movie every day because she's lonely. It's the 30s. It's the Depression. She ends up falling in love with him. But then the actor who actually plays that part, she meets too, the real guy, and she falls in love with him too. So it's this interesting love story. Woody Allen really took that to the next level.
Yeah.
And it's really a magical movie that's about movies, you know.
It's one of my favorite of his.
Yeah,
it's,
it really is. That and Radio Days. Radio Days I don't have on my list here, but Radio Days is up there too in terms of that magical type of feeling for that time.
Well, the thing with Radio Days is it doesn't, I have this, like, you watch it and it takes you back to a time and place that you had nothing to do with. But it feels like you're like, oh, it's my family. Yeah. Like, my family's nothing like that.
And
my world
really is good jokes in it.
Yeah.
Some really classic jokes in it. Yeah. Okay, I got two more doubleheaders. Ready?
Awesome.
And the last two doubleheaders both have arguably my top two films.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the first one is The Graduate, which is my all-time best film, favorite film is The Graduate. I don't know what it is. There's something about the story of isolation and loneliness that he's going through that I connected to as well, which a lot of people did at the time. Mike Nichols' vision for that, still, I can't get over, you know, just the visual part of it. Yes, I fell in love with Mrs. Robinson too. Once again, I'm in an illicit romance here.
Yeah.
That's the story of my life. But I can't get enough of that. You know, here I am. I want him to end up with Mrs. Robinson. But she's so damaged and everything, you know. And the power of that film with all of that, with Dustin Hoffman and just a fantastic performance, you know, Catherine Ross, of course, so beautiful.
Yeah, he's got that dumpy daughter, right?
Yes. The music makes that movie what it is. It really does. I cannot think of that movie without going dee 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 dee, you know, and thinking of that. And Sound of Silence makes that whole sequence more than what it is. You've turned the sound down. You go, oh, okay, it's interesting. And it's funny because not all great movies are like that. Many great movies turn the sound down. You still go, woo, what's going on there? You know. This is when you turn the sound down, you go, oh, okay, he's just walking around.
But did it, because here, it's funny you say it's you know, easily one of my favorites as well, but I every time I go back to it, there's this moment of, oh, shit, this is even better than I remember.
It is better.
You know, you talk about The Sting. I know I love The Sting. The Sting is all just, it's there. It's bright candy. It's a lovely.
Sure.
But what is it about, the story's terrific. Everything about it's terrific.
Yeah.
But why is it so?
It's a transition movie. It's a movie about something people hadn't really dramatized. You know, it was taking the feeling that people had experienced with Catcher in the Rye in the novel form.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and, you know, this type of anti-hero type of thing. And the movie was supposed to be about blonde people in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, and white O'Neill.
And really Caucasian white. And Nichols, you know, said, I think it's more about transplanted Jews, you know. And because he's fucking, he was brilliant at such a young age, you know, he was able to imagine this a different way and kind of fought for Dustin Hoffman, I think, when I think Redford was someone they really wanted.
I think
Beatty and those type of people they were looking at would have been a completely different type of movie. Yeah. But I think it speaks to his, a lot of it is Dustin Hoffman, too, by the way. And he has a there's something about him where he just wants something, even though he doesn't know what it is. And we've all experienced that, you know, and he goes down a dark road, which I think we've experienced too, you know, and, you know, there's no, it's not clean. The movie is not clean at all. Even the end is messy.
Yeah.
So there's no clean resolution in this either, you know, but he's trying, you know, he's doing that, you know, but the music, the whole sequence, the brilliant sequence coming out of the pool and the hotel, it's the music that unites that, you know.
Yeah,
it really ties it together and lifts it to that level that makes it a special film, you know, that makes it indelible. But there's so many parts of it. And we just lost Buck Henry, who was fantastic as the writer of the film and in the film,
giant
of course, too.
Exactly.
So that's, you know, the intelligence behind that.
Yeah.
You know, we know where that comes from. You know?
Yeah.
So the double feature of this might surprise some people because it's not as it's not so much that type of movie, but it is a movie where music to me made it more than what it is Coolie High.
Oh, wow. Sure.
Now, Coolie High is a movie, it was a lot of people called it the Black American Graffiti at the time, but it was more than that for me because for me, my parents were from Chicago and it took place in Chicago and Cabrini bring projects. They didn't grow up in the projects though. And it was this period of time where music has such a, just this great meaning for people in their lives, you know, and that type of stuff. And to see Black people on screen for me, I still have so much affection for Coolie High. You can see my body language as I'm talking about. Yeah. I love seeing Black people on screen, not just in one role, but in this way of being kids and doing that. Lawrence Hilton Jacobs in a fantastic role, you know, as coaches, as basketball player. Glenn Turman, best thing I've ever seen. Every time I see Glenn Turman, all I'm thinking about is Coolie High.
Right.
And I know he's done all these other things, but I just want to tell him how much I love him. You know, the character Preach was, he wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. You know, he had the glasses and everything. What happens to me later? I watched this one of my most indelible movies.
And you're wearing glasses.
Yes. And the show What's Happening was kind of modeled after.
Kind of the way American or Happy Days was sort of modeled after American Graffiti.
Exactly. And I think they wanted to, Coolie High had a lot of seriousness in it too. You know, in fact, the ending was very sad. It wasn't like a happy ending type of movie where, you know, American Graffiti was a little more melancholy in its in its ending, you know, which by the way is a fantastic movie. It would be on my list, but I could have put those two
together.
But it seemed a little obvious to put it. I think it hurts Coolie High by being put together American Graffiti.
Yeah.
You know? But putting it together with The Graduate makes it different because the music of that period, and some of it was a bit anachronistic because they used some stuff out of the time, but for the most part, that's the music, first music that I heard. First music I heard, Josh. And, you know, it just means so much to me. And I fell in love with the girl that Preach was trying to, you know, get with too. I was a teenager, first thinking about these things, you know. Loved everything about Coolie High. My brother and I loved that movie when it came out. You know, it's hard to find now, though. But
I think there's a I think there's a DVD of it, not a, Blu-ray. The no, that was one of my first. You know, I grew up in a weird neighborhood. It was actually in West Philly. That was very integrated. And I remember, you know, my dad told me everything. I saw it and was like, oh, that's great. And it kind of reminds me a bit of where I live and all the rest of that. But it was the first time I had seen like the Black kids I knew seeing a movie where they have seen themselves on screen.
Yeah.
And there was this thing where I was like, oh, this is not for me.
Yeah.
In an amazing where I, and it started making me think that like, oh, pretty much everything is for me. And this is what I would be like if every now and then they actually, you know.
I love that you said that because I don't think that when I see American Graffiti, but white people think that when they see Coolie High.
Well, here's
what I don't think that's not for me. I just go, oh, that's interesting.
That's interesting.
Yes.
Well, my big gripe is a few years later when Dazed and Confused came out, which is a pretty lovely film. I can't connect to Dazed and Confused on any level. We didn't have cars. We didn't have a football team.
Sure.
I'm like, it's all these.
Right.
And everybody I know will tell you like, oh man, that's what like growing up in the 70s was like.
Right.
I'm like, nah. And then I see Crooklyn And like, that actually looks like my neighborhood.
Right.
They're listening to all the stuff we listen. They're playing Rock and Sock and Robots. I can identify with almost everything in that movie.
Right.
But no one will ever say about Crooklyn, that's what growing up in the 70s was like.
Right.
Even though I'm like, I would argue if, you know, if the world revolves around me, it was.
Yeah. And American Graffiti is more middle class.
Yeah.
You know, where Cooley High is more, you know, working class, lower class, that type of thing.
But it was just, it was really interesting to start to recognize that, you know, I'm part of a culture that dominates everything.
Right.
And everything is made for me.
Right.
And like, oh, wow. And if every now and then we dole stuff out to people, they actually enjoy it.
Dole stuff out.
But you know, that's what it is. We're gonna, you guys can, take you, that you can have one of
there
these.
There you go. Yeah, just don't make too much noise.
You know, I remember once, you know, I've seen, what was the, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Because
I'd seen a million of those movies that it's part of that, you know, it's a great film.
Yeah.
I remember kind of sitting there going, oh, I'm not sure it's quite, and I look behind me and there was this like 12-year-old Asian girl watching Michelle Yeoh and just her eyes are just popping out of her head. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I've seen 50 million versions of myself kicking ass and taking names on screen.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure she is.
Richard Pryor had a great bit about how much he hated Jerry West, even though he loved him. You know, but he hated the fact that he loved him so much because he was this white guy who was good at basketball. So he did not like liking him. He hated that. You know, it was really funny. It was one of his early routines too. All right. So my last doubleheader, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So the first one is, I don't know how many people have seen this. It's very unusual, but these two movies, so the way that Sherlock Jr. and Purple Rose of Cairo were about movies,
right? You know,
this is about film itself. These two.
Okay.
And in some cases, the film stock itself, you know, which is kind of interesting.
Okay. Every one of these, I'm trying to guess.
The first one is a contemporary film, not contemporary, but
documentary.
Yes. And it's Bill Morrison's film, Dawson City, Frozen Time.
Yes. 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 Yes.
So you're familiar with this?
Oh, yeah.
It's fascinating.
It's an amazing film.
So for those of you that don't know this, you have to see this movie. What it is there is this film that was made about this city, Dawson City, and it was like buried in the ground or something like that.
Yeah, it was a town, what is it, in Alaska?
I think it's in Alaska.
And it was the end of the line for all the
movies. Yes, it was the end of the line. So what would happen is movies would be distributed all around the country. And so a movie, like whenever you see old movies where it looks kind of like it's a bad thing or whatever, it's because it went through the projector so many times. Right. And by the time it would get to Alaska, they'd get the worst version of it. But it was also, they never would send it back.
Right.
You know,
it was ruined at that point.
Exactly.
Like, and they would not re-release them.
They didn't care anyway.
We're done. We made our money.
Yes. And then they could show it whenever. And for whatever reason, these movies were stored somewhere and they were just forgotten.
Yeah.
You know, and
the bottom of a lake.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And the story about this is fascinating. Yeah. So, and what Bill Morrison's genius is. Okay. So the condition of these films back then were done on what's called a silver nitrate stock, and they deteriorated very rapidly, or they could burn very quickly and that type of thing. They had to be preserved carefully. Now, these were actually preserved because they were underground, but they still had a certain amount of deterioration because this film was done in the 20s. This is what we're talking about, the period of time. It's the 1920s. And for some of this, there's a couple of films in this area, but Dawson City, I believe, is maybe the teens and 20s, I believe.
Well, yeah, when they were getting the movie.
I believe so, when they first shot it, right? So they've been in the ground for almost 100 years or whatever, or whatever it was when they first unearthed this for a long time. So Bill Morrison puts this together, and the whole point of the film is you're seeing damaged film.
Very damaged.
Yes, but it turns it into art.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. It creates a whole different level of reality and feeling because you're watching something that you realize has aged. And it has this, the film stock itself has a story to tell.
Yeah.
It has its own story to tell. And so you're looking at the people and you're looking at the film stock itself. And it's fascinating, the feeling that it gives you. You know, you're going, wow, it's. And there are some things that are, it's very hard to see something. And then all of a sudden an image comes up that is crystal clear. And you see people doing whatever they're doing. And then it goes back into something else. And there's like where it looks like the film, you know, how it gets real blurry, or it looks like where a film catches on fire, like that look that it has when it, when it does that type of thing, you know. And the movie is an experience.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's an experience. If you seek it out, guys. Bill Morrison's Dawson City, Frozen Time. you will be happy if you like them. Yeah,
I'm sure.
I'm so happy that you've seen
it. Oh, yeah. No, there's a great Blu-ray of it. The what's interesting to me, too, is that they are the films, you know, they're not curated. They're just the movies that made Dawson Creek in whatever, 1920 or Dawson exactly Creek, right. Dawson City.
Right, Dawson City. Creek. Yeah, Dawson Creek is the show. Yeah. Now, the other one that's is Dawson
of,
Creek.
That's a bunch of porno VHSs that James Vanderbeek.
It's been preserved, Dawson Creek.
All his original Pee-wee's playhouses. Yeah. No, but they're not like, you're not seeing scenes from, you know, Buster Keaton films. You're seeing exactly. scenes from movies that have been utterly exactly forgotten, right. starring completely. People who have been completely forgotten.
Completely.
So right. they're just like ghosts from yes. this era that you
That's
have
a great
known.
Way to put it.
Yeah, it's
an awesome way to put it.
Yeah.
As well as documentary footage
yeah.
of the town and itself. Great. And
by the way, just like a documentary about the town.
Yes, it's
is terrific. And then you bring in this other, yeah, no.
It works on so great, many levels.
Yeah,
so
I'm, many now levels. I'm real, I'm like.
And this is what I mean by contemporary artists still influence me and still touch me in ways where I go, wow, you know. It makes me want to do something, you know, or whatever. I don't know what, but I just, cause I go, I can't believe somebody thought of that. You yeah. know?
Well, I can't, it's now I'm sitting here like, I can't. So the other, I'm trying, don't tell me yet, but I'm like, what the hell would that be? It's also about film as opposed to,
yeah.
what's another, I'm completely, I got no idea.
All right. It's probably, if The Graduate is first, this movie's probably second.
Okay.
Okay. And it is Cinema Paradiso.
Shit. Okay. Yes. And of course, the end of the with the reel. And
Cinema Paradiso is a magical film. If you have not beautiful. Seen it, it is everything about it transports you. And it's about film.
Yeah.
And it's about film itself as well as the magic of film. It's both.
Yep.
You know, and this little boy whose dream is to be the projectionist, like his hero, who is the projectionist right now. That's all he wants to do. He's transported by these films. It takes place in Italy. And in the movie is supposed to take place during World War II, I believe, is when the kid is real little. And Toto, the little kid, is fantastic. And by the way, do not, if you have not seen this movie, do not rent the dub version. Slap on your hand. I'll slap you in your face. Don't do it. Get the original Italian and the subtitles, because to hear his voice, especially the little kid, Alfredo. Toto, no.
Yes.
Toto, no. He's always there. And the relationship between the guy and the kid is so fantastic. But it's about film.
Yes.
And the punch at the end of this movie when, you know, this person has been on this journey. Of course, it has things in it about love that you can't have and all those great things that are in good films, whatever. But the punch you do not see coming. Yeah. You just don't see it.
Yeah.
And it just knocks. I cried like a baby watching that, you know. And for those of you that have seen it, you know what I'm talking about. I'm not saying it because if you haven't seen it, I really don't
That's
want
to true.
Spoil
yeah.
it.
And if you see
know.
It, you also see it
You
in
know
context.
What I'm talking about. Yeah. It's in context. But it's beautiful to think of that ending. I don't know if that person, if that was their experience or whatever it is, but it's one of the most beautiful endings of a film, Josh, that I think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And it instantly became one of my favorites. I used to talk about it all the time with my friends. I still talk about it to this day. I saw a revival of it like a year ago somewhere. It's just magic.
There is a movie I would like to, you may know of. It's impossible to get legitimately, and I'll tell our listeners, go find it wherever you can. Mm-hmm. Do you know, Ladies and Gentlemen, Final Cut?
Mm-mm.
Or maybe it's called Final Cut, Ladies and Gentlemen. It is. I'm going to get every detail wrong. I believe it's a Hungarian director. I believe Eastern European director.
Uh-huh.
Loses the financing. And this is the true story behind it. Loses the financing for his movie like right before it's supposed to go. Which, if you've been there, is
horrible. Yeah.
A debilitating place. And he locks himself in an editing room.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes all these movies and he starts cutting together a film.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses clips. And the reason you can't get it commercially is he uses clips from hundreds of movies and even a few TV shows.
Mm.
And he decided he wanted to tell a story, kind of universal story, using all these pieces of movies. And he realized there's basically two stories. There's Stranger Comes to Town and there's Boy Meets Girl. So he does Boy Meets Girl.
Right.
And it is just scene after shot after scene after shot from most of the movies you know, but even if you don't.
Right.
And it tells the story of a boy and a girl meeting.
Classic story, yeah.
But every shot is from a different film, from a different era. And you sit there and it works.
Wow.
And it carries you through this narrative.
Wow.
And it's like, I've seen it a bunch of times. Every time I see it, I'm like, I'm both like just demolished by its brilliance.
Yeah.
And then there's this, also this little thing of like, Oh, fuck, man. We just tell the same stupid fucking stories over and over again. We got to come up with a third one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's an amazing film.
Oh, wow. I have to seek it out. Yeah.
But it's out there. You can find it. Worth checking out. But was that your last?
That's it. That's my last.
Holy shit, Larry! That was an epic journey.
Was that
man.
Fun? Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, Don is. Yes,
I enjoyed putting that together because I didn't know how to talk about it. I thought, I don't know. I don't know if I, like I said, yeah. There's maybe three or four movies I could talk about in detail, maybe. Yeah. But I forget so many things. You know? But I'd rather talk about why it means something to me.
Yeah, well, that's why we're here.
Yeah,
man.
Exactly.
That's the point.
You know, there's others that I couldn't fit in or whatever, but this is most of it, you know.
No, but that is really like the core of what we're trying to do. I mean, I've been a fan of yours forever.
Oh, thanks.
There's aspects of that, obviously, where I do know you. There's aspects where I know this person you project who's obviously
sure,
right. But that was such an amazing insight into how you think about things and your process.
Well, the things that influence me, I still take to this day. Like, I take cues from it. Like, I take cues from Groucho all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
well.
When I was doing Insecure, you know, when thinking about Issa, you know, I was thought about was Buster Keaton, believe it or not. She has a stillness that just works that you just don't want to mess with too much. You know, you just want to let her, you want to paint stuff on her more than you want her to do.
Oh, stuff yeah. Because that was, you know? Buster.
Because she's
that.
So expressive. With the simplest things, right. You know? I mean, I think about this stuff all the time. I think about Python, all of that stuff, you know, Graduate, all the movies I talk about, they're swirling in my head at some point. It comes out and
I mean, do you feel like when you're doing, I do this all the time, and then, I think the trick is realize you're at least competent when you get away with it, is like you're stealing stuff, turning it into something else and throwing it out there, and then no one knows you stole it.
Well, it's not that for me. For me, it's kind of what it inspires me to want to do.
Okay, yeah.
It's more what it does for me. I'm trying to think if there's an example. I think even the Bernie Mac show, it's Groucho talking to the camera, you know?
Yep.
You know? I have to stay here. You folks can go home. You don't have to.
Well, that's what I'm talking. It's like you say that, and I'm like, I can see that line, but you're watching it, and you don't go, oh, yeah, that's great.
Don't think that. It's just more inside of there where I just like the fact that Groucho talks to me. So I like Bernie Mac talking to me. You know?
Exactly.
It's like it's pretty much that simple, really, you know. So, yeah, so it's standing on the shoulders of all those things, and you just intuit it. But I haven't done the thing where it's like, I'm taking this sort of thing and trying to use it, unless I did it for satirical reasons.
Right.
You know, and that, of course, you do all the time.
But I'm talking more about sort of like as you're doing something, it reminds you of something, kind of what you were just talking about.
Yeah.
As opposed to, not just lifting a scene and hoping no one will.
Right. No,
you.
No. But I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Where you, I think when you're starting out, you do a lot of that stuff too, like especially in stand-up where you're trying to be somebody and then you find your own voice, you know, and sometimes in writing.
And the fun thing too is everything is, I think I mentioned, you know, when I first started out, I God help me, I wrote some comedies and was like, oh, that's not for me. But I stole a scene from The Love Bug where a guy is standing on the street and he sees two headlights come towards him and he ducks and the headlights go around him. I thought, no one will know. This is a 30-year-old movie or whatever it was at the time. But I always felt guilty about it.
Yes.
Cut 2 years later, I'm watching a Buster Keaton film.
Yes.
Exact same fucking gag.
Okay, now that you're thinking, I did something that subconsciously I didn't know what I was doing. And then I realized later I actually took it from something. And I'll tell you what, we were doing the Bernie Mac show and there was something that happened. I can't remember if it was a kid kidnapped or someone's house was broken into. And they were watching the news. They were watching it as a family, you know, and they were kind of just watching, and I just wanted them to watch it, you know, and just get the effect of seeing this and how it made them feel a little closer together. And I realized, fuck, Larry, that was radio days. You know, Woody Allen wrote that when the girl fell down the well, you know, and I didn't know subconsciously that I wrote the same type of scene, you know, until after. And then I realized, like, almost like a year later, I go, oh, fuck.
Did you have it in there? Because I remember years ago seeing something and realizing like, oh, my God, I stole directly from this. But I just, it was so completely unconscious of having done it.
That's what I mean. It was so ingrained in my subconscious. Yeah. I didn't know that it was the same, basically the same scene. Yeah. Of course, it's a lot different.
Yeah, no, but you have to tell people that you stole.
Yes, no one would have known.
Exactly.
No one would have known. But if I told them, they would go, oh, yeah,
right.
I guess so. You know, they would see the difference or where it was inspired or that type of thing.
Yeah.
But sometimes, it's just like the the feeling that I want that something had that I want this scene to have, you know, or that type of thing, or this particular thing that I'm writing. I'll do that kind of thing all the time, you know.
Yeah.
My brain is just racing right now. And there are some things that I just don't know. Like Clockwork Orange, it's just in there, but I've never done
it.
I've never done
it. What would you do with it?
Never. I've never done anything with it. I'm not proud that it's stuck in there, but it is. Nothing I can do about it. Thank you, Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, we'll call the police when you do.
Actually. Yes, exactly. Ultra violence, little brother.
Yes. Well, thank you again so very
much. Next time we'll have lamb chops of toast.
It's been absolutely
thanks,
thrill.
Man. It's been great.
And hey, good luck with that little podcast here. Like, we will crush you.
Back on the air. Thanks, man.
Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of trailersfromhell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.